Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is George. I'm in Alameda at Mark Georgis' house. But I've known you for quite a while now. It seems like we met maybe like back in the early days of what we would refer to as the Spock Mark scene. I don't know what other people would call it, but... Yeah.
99, 98, 99, 2000.
Around that era, And so at the time, so for background sake, at the time you were playing in Monopause, which kind of in a couple of years, would you say it evolved into Nunkpop? Or they kind of are separate entities?
I consider them separate entities.
Yeah, they're kind of separate.
They're so different. Yeah. But it did evolve into Nunkpop.
A lot of the same players.
It was most of the same players, and Monopause had been going on since 1993.
Really?
Yeah, our 20th anniversary is next year.
Actually. Are you going to do something for it?
I can't say. I can't confirm or deny.
Oh, this is like a confirm or deny. Okay. So anyway, that has it always been you and Peter, and then your brothers in it?
Yeah, Peter Conheim and I, and my brother joined after our first show. There were a couple of other people that have moved town. There's a guy named Mike Shizuru, who we worked with closely for years. That was the early Monopause. Brian Hall.
Brentley.
And then Brentley, eventually. And by...
I never see Brentley.
No.
Is he around?
He's around.
What's he do? He does other bands.
He does. Well, he's legendary. He's in 3 Day Stubble.
Right. 3 Day Stubble.
Which still exists. One great project he did in the early 90s was I think he was bass playing and guitar playing on Heavenly Ten Stems.
Oh, okay.
Which was like the...
we've talked about this before.
The grandfather of Nunkpop, actually. It was,
really?
Mark Davies of Thinking Fellers and a host of other people doing their favorite Chinese and Indian cuts, that they've been collecting and doing reinterpretations of those. That was really great.
Yeah, maybe you should sidebar on that, because I do remember... At the time, the first thing I'd ever heard about that band was, I'm trying to remember, I might have been my friend or a friend of a friend at UC Berkeley throwing paint on them, I think at the Chameleon, when they performed. Were you at that show?
No, I was at the show a week later when they played in plain clothes, just t-shirt and jeans. It was the last show they'd ever do.
Right, so do you think that they used to dress up, that's part
of
it.
Yeah, they dressed up, They played the parts like Lala in the band, who was singing dressed up in sort of Chinese opera style, and that was very unfortunate what happened to them.
Do you think it was just an overreaction?
I think it was overreaction, and also probably naive, and probably had to do with a lot of people trying to get into their own racial self-discovery, and then. It was portrayed by somebody in that group as something that was potentially racist, and then everybody attached onto that and said, well, let's get them. It's a witch hunt.
But was it just one person, or was it a group? I didn't even know. I thought it was just kind of a one-person agenda.
It was one person's...
He threw paint on them.
Crusade, maybe, and
paint balloon. I should talk to them about it.
I have a video.
Watched
it.
Oh, man.
It's really sad to see because, well, first of all, these people were just doing, what any of us do and what we did with Nunkpop as well. It was really evident that they were paying homage to this music, and that, we've all been in bands. It takes a lot of time to whip songs into shape on that level, especially highly orchestrated pieces like that.
Yeah, and to, learn a cover in a language you don't know.
It's remarkable.
Level of a thing.
And they did such a good job of it that anybody who had witnessed them could tell that they were just in love with the music.
Yeah, and I think this was, you're right, it was, also the early 90s where I feel like there was this sort of, it's definitely still watchdogs about, oh, this seems like an appropriation, and this seems like another thing, and that really, that dialogue from that must kind of still translate into, what you and, the bishops were working on now, because it's still a thing where people like to point fingers, and I actually went into it not having a solid opinion about it, because I just heard that it had happened, and I just kind of wanted to get everyone inside of it. And I think I had read, did they maybe write a letter to Banana Fish or something about it? I don't know where, they did air like kind of their side of that story, didn't they?
I'm not sure whether they did or not, actually.
But you know them well enough that you can maybe speak to what they...
Oh, yeah.
But it was definitely a tribute. And
it was a tribute. Yeah, like, yeah.
But I don't know exactly what... I mean, I think, like, maybe the dressing up might have been part of it that, like, really, like, went over the edge for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I guess it's like, you know, you could just... see in different situations, like, something that you take personally and someone else, like, seems to take as a joke in your mind, then it could go to the point where you're just like, yeah, that's not cool.
I know how that works, yeah. And things do get exaggerated, and like you said, it was of the times. I think the mm-hmm. early 90s was very different than even the late 90s, mm-hmm. even in the Bay Area, maybe especially, because people moved here from all over the place and adopted this sort of, you know, sometimes outlandish PC philosophies that went against even all logic, you know.
Right.
And we're still suffering from some of that. But, you know, you always have that coming in and out, and the Bay Area is famous for that.
Yeah, people just kind of come here and I discover themselves and become like...
Or reinvent themselves.
Or become mega militant about whatever their niche thing is.
Mm-hmm. Apparently in 1994, when the Heavenly Ten Stems... fiasco went down. I mean, it was, you know, a group of Chinese students and others that took it personally, and I think it was misinformed and certainly malintentioned, in my opinion, because that's not the way to start a dialogue.
No, it's not, and it's sort of like a thing where it's kind of a forgotten thing at this point, except for maybe those of us that were kind of around it and like remember that thing. I don't think people think about that.
No. At all. They ceased operations immediately.
Yeah.
They, you know...
And Brentley was in that.
Brentley was in that.
So when you guys started Nungpak, mm-hmm. did he have any sort of thoughts like, oh, we better make sure we're not going to dress up and we're not going to do anything like that?
No, not at all. It was just like, well, we'll do everything we want, but we'll wear bulletproof vests. And we'll protect the gear with plastic. No, we were ready for that, actually. And we had talked about it. Like, well, we're, you know...
Because, like, let's back up and explain what Nungpak was. So coming out of Monopause, which was, you know, like sort of like this experimental art rock kind of thing. Well, we had a band.
We did.
There's like,
don't we still have a band? Aren't we on in about 2 hours?
Yeah, I don't know if we can really... We don't want to give away the trade secrets. But actually, the other thing that's weird about you and I is we're also birthday buddies.
That's
the same birthday.
That's correct.
But we also have a band called...
Peak hours and the nighttime minutes.
Like, that's how active it is that I forgot the name of it.
Well, I mean,
that was like also like funnier like 6 years ago when I came up with it.
And maybe it's more retro than anything now.
It is very retro.
I mean, who thinks about peak hours anymore?
No, it's like a band called the Calling Cards or something,
right? Or the Pagers, or the
what is the thing that the scam thing people used to pull in the '90s that you'd hold up to the phone and it could do the dial tone for you. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, you can hold it up to payphones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would like work on payphones.
You'd get free calls.
You get free calls.
Yeah, yeah. I used that a couple of times.
Yeah. Oh, old technology.
Yeah.
We were kind of getting into some conspiracy stuff before we even got into this stuff. But Oh, that also reminds me of White Ring.
Mm.
We should talk about that for
a second. The White Ring. Yeah.
The White Ring, because that was kind of a Monopause-related thing.
There was a point where Monopause was doing three different acts. We were doing Monopause... And we were doing Nungpak, and we were doing something called The White Ring, which debuted before 9/11.
Oh, we did it.
Okay, I think it was
about after.
April of 2001.
Okay.
The White Ring were, well, we all met in the Gulf War. We're Gulf War veterans, and, you know, we had a common interest, and that interest was music. We would play, you know, to the troops. And,
it's kind of like the monks. That's like how the monks
sort of
started.
Like the monks, but like we had Germany, a bit of a different philosophy. We were, you know, big supporters of all wars, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we drove nicer vehicles than most of you guys did. And, you know, we played golf on Sunday. We're just like anybody else after church, of course.
Actually, I think I remember the thing I remember most about it, what, like one show, I think it was maybe a Heckos, was, I think... Someone came, you had a singer, and she was a survivor of an attempted abortion.
That's right. That's right.
And that might have been...
No, that was our pro-life phase, where we did a few tracks. One of them made it to the stage. That was the... She was a survivor of an abortion. I mean, she didn't survive that well, but she was pretty again after years of
reconstructive.
Which, I mean, that stuff's come a long way.
Yeah.
They can... face on a, you know, you take some bath salts, you eat somebody's face, you get a new face.
Oh my God.
But, that was before 9/11, but after 9/11 we were galvanized, you know, just by our patriotism alone and able to try to spread the message to this Bay Area that was really kind of down on the whole thing. So that was, it was a good message.
Yeah, you made a video, as I recall, that we showed on Burn My Eye.
That's right.
That video, and
it was about TIPS project for Homeland Security. Yeah. We were, you know, huge proponents of that, and trying to, I mean, basically, it's like, you know, if you have an in like we do to the kind of, well, we were part of the indie Christian scene of the early '90s here,
big scene,
and it was great. And
who were some other bands in that scene?
Oh, you had Elder Weldon. You had. Okay. There was It's All God.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember them. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a burgeoning scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And those shows. So you guys were part of that scene.
We were part of that scene, and that kind of graduated into, you know, what we became after that, which was The White Ring. And you know, we had a good message, and I think that message was conveyed, and we were able to... We did a 9/11 commemorative show on the first anniversary of 9/11, and we invited the mayor of San Francisco, and it was on the register as you know, vets were going to show up and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We showed up in a limo. We had to leave pretty quick.
Where was that?
It was at a liberal art gallery in San Francisco, and we thought that would be the best place to take this message.
Right.
Back at home, David of the White Ring offers a personal perspective on total information awareness.
You know, ever since we came back from the war, if we're not touring, I drive taxi in San Francisco, and this allows me to do two things. One is that I'm able to give the word of the Lord to the people. Two is I'm able to look at the suspicious activity that's going on, especially since 9/11. I mean, you look around San Francisco, and we're talking about a haven for potential terror.
Yes, taking Homeland Security into your own hands is a 24-hour business, employing any citizen, anytime, anywhere.
But yeah, so we had a video about, you know, kind of like telling on your friends if you see something suspicious.
Right.
And
if you see something, say something.
That kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. But we were the innovators of that.
Oh, right, yeah.
And we turned in a lot of friends.
Because Homeland Security equals an informed, proactive citizenry.
Nungpak, you guys were playing specifically, what was it specifically that you were playing?
Southeast Asian
just
music.
All different countries.
And yeah, different it was after a trip my brother and I had taken to Thailand and Laos and Burma, and spent 6 months out there and taking in like the all of the bar bands in Bangkok, covering like their contemporaries who were very popular at the time. But you'd have hundreds of Asian bar bands everywhere doing this kind of stuff.
And playing instrumentation, not like backing tracks.
No, all instrumentation. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then also it was informed by the kind of hybrid folk pop that we were seeing in northeastern Thailand, like the rural country mm-hmm. music. And, you know, Monopause had been active for several years. And, I think in one moment of writer's block or something, we came back and said, why don't we try doing some of this music? I mean, it's... Mm-hmm. It'd be great to take it to the stage and people can experience that.
And the literal translation of Nungpak is mono pause, right?
Nungpak was supposed to be literally mono pause. Yeah. Nung being one and Pak being a short stop.
Uh-huh.
But we got a call into Calyx when we were on the station from a Thai guy who said it actually just means one vegetable. But we were fine
still
with
okay.
that.
Yeah, that's still fine.
That's fine.
And so that was the lineup, and then like Liz was in that too. Right?
Yeah, Liz Albee was in the later incarnation,
lineup or...
and Jason Stamberger came in. And,
oh yeah,
and so the
and Tyler was the drummer.
And Tyler was the drummer. Miles was the original drummer, Miles Stegall, and he was the Monopause drummer.
Right,
mostly.
He moved to Portland though.
He moved to Portland. He's actually back this month in the Bay Area.
Okay. Yeah. Cool.
And so yeah, it evolved, and we started Nungpak in 2001, and we just put our second album out last week.
Oh, wait, and Diana was in it.
Diana Hayes.
That's like actually probably the most important element. Yeah,
absolutely.
Like, she was not in Monopause. I'm like, oh, wait, who was the singer? Diana.
Mm-hmm.
But she learned all her parts phonetically, right? Is that...
We all did.
Everything was learned phonetically.
Yeah, yeah. And some of it we would actually check with Thai friends, or Diana's half Thai, so she'd mm-hmm. check with her mom. And
that's right, because she didn't speak.
No.
Right, that was the thing. That's interesting.
Everything was learned phonetically, and then we'd fudge it if it, you know, on stage you can't... I'd have, like, cue cards on the stage sometimes, but they'd get knocked over, so I just fudge it.
Yeah.
Well, I remember seeing you guys play, and it might have been a record release show or something, where you were playing with one of the kind of youth bands from the Thai Temple in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And those guys were ripping. They were really,
really
good.
Really good.
And I was like, I've been back to Thai Temple a couple times, but I've never stuck around. I don't know when they go on. They go on at like 1 or 2 or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I found them there because I'd seen them play years ago. It's a music school that they have there, so it's a rotating cast of youth that come in.
The Berkeley Thai Temple, which is now better known as a Sunday kind of restaurant at this point. I mean, they do so well with that part of it. And I remember going in the 90s, and it was not super well known, but I think it's also at the same time that everyone fell in love with Thai food everywhere.
It's true.
It's kind of like it was a coincidental
thing. I don't even bother going there because you can't get a plate. You know, you can't get a seat.
Well, and like it's weird too because I have a friend who's like, her mom was Thai and like she actually would go there. I don't think she was religious, but they did like, when her mom died, they did like a funeral service there and stuff like that. So, like it's just like for some people, it's just like, oh, this is a place we actually go and like feel connected to our roots. Mm-hmm. And then to a bunch of Berkeley people, it's just like, crazy place to go on Sunday after you've been out drinking on Saturday.
Exactly.
And that kind of happens a lot of the time.
It really
does.
With
a lot of different things.
It does. Yeah, great Thai food. But, it was really, that was the last Nung Pak show that we planned to do, and that was in 2008. And
I saw the last one.
Okay. You did, yeah. We sort of ceased after that, and but then we made a second record, which just came out this month.
Oh, I saw that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And is that, you released that? Or
Abduction, Alan Bishop's
Alan
the Sunset Girls
it,
label.
Okay.
Yeah. And all the releases have been on Abduction now. But there was a 7-year gap, I think, between the two records.
And even going further back a little bit, I know there was like this label, Electromotive.
Yeah.
Was that you?
That's Peter Kahn's label.
That's Peter's label. And then that's what your stuff, the Monopost stuff, came out on that, right?
Yeah, some of it. Yeah, actually all of it did. Electromotive label has been going on since 1991 at least.
Yeah.
Early Bay Area days of this.
Yeah. I should ask Peter. I also should ask Peter about some of these things.
Yeah.
But I remember a little bit about that scene because I think you guys were all like, I don't know if we overlapped because I think in the early 90s, I was going to like shows like Gilman and stuff.
Sure.
I was not really, I would maybe once in a while go see like something at like Bean Benders, which was in downtown Berkeley.
Oh, yeah.
And
there would
be like, I think I remember seeing like Scott Amendola play to like me and my friend, pretty much. That was like kind of the vibe of that. And it was like a little bit like, oh, I don't, this stuff's cool, but why is there no one here? I didn't understand how it worked. And then I think because there was a generation before me, which was like, I guess maybe you guys and like Alexa was booking shows
at the Heinz.
And I would hear about those shows because my sister was up in here and it would be like, oh yeah, Mike Watt just played at this like Vietnamese restaurant.
Yeah. It was really a charged time around here, 91 to about 95, I'd say.
Yeah, I feel like I was a little bit out of the loop. I didn't really know how to find what you guys were doing.
Mm.
So, but it does seem like it was kind of a coherent scene. There was sort of like bands like, I would say like, I never got into them, but I know Idiot Flesh was kind of like a big band in that time period.
Yeah,
and they would be like the band people would talk about. Mm. It was like, to me, some of that stuff was like kind of like after Primus or after that kind of like weird East Bay. Mm. There was all this funk punk stuff going on that was like kind of mainstreamish a little
that,
bit.
Yeah, that was like 87, 88, 89, 90, 91. That started, I mean, before that there were a lot of, you know, punk bands like when I was about 15, 1985.
So wait, when did you move to the Bay Area? Because didn't you grow up?
I grew up here. Yeah,
you grew up here. Yeah. Your family's Michigan?
Well, no, I have a lot of family in Michigan,
okay,
but my mom is a Bay Area native.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so we were talking about this a second ago, so there's, I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about it, but thing. So your dad's Iraqi and your mom's Iraqi? Or?
I'm not allowed to talk about
that. Oh, you're not allowed to talk about it. Bring them into it. But,
No, yeah, my dad is Iraqi. He's from Baghdad, and he moved to the States in the early 60s. And he was living in Germany for a while, and my mom had won a Del Monte Foods sweepstakes to tour Europe. And they met at the Kronzler Cafe in Berlin.
Wow.
And it was love, and they got married in London. And
so she's American.
Yeah, she's a California native.
Oh wow, she won a Del Monte. Del Monte had contests like that, like buy a can of peaches and then you get it to go to Europe.
So the story goes, unless someone's bending the truth. My mom submitted this card like at 11:59 p.m. the day of the day of the sweepstakes deadline.
Wow, and you might not be here if not for that.
Del Monte owes me a living.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. Or you owe them something, I don't know.
Something.
Yeah, there's some kind of symbiosis. Like you, the Jolly Green Giant, I don't know, that might not be them.
And I may be even forgetting, like, whether it's Del Monte or Duncan Hines or something. I'm pretty
sure it was like, Big Food Co.
From
which
back
is
then.
Funny, because now it's like, yeah, those people are, like, probably destroying more lives now.
Yeah, they're all Monsanto-owned, you know, entities. Like,
yeah, totally. But so you grew up in the Bay Area. You and your brother, it's just you and your brother.
Yeah, I was born in San Diego, yeah. And then right after that, we moved to Oakland.
So you've been around for all of the stuff.
Yeah, in Oakland, I was here in the early 70s, and then my parents, you know, decided to move to the suburbs, and we grew up in the Pleasant Hill, Lafayette, Walnut Creek triad over there.
Right.
And
you think they thought it was like a little rough to raise a kid in Oakland in the 70s?
I think at that time, the word on the street here, you know, for middle class people was get out of town and don't bring your kids. This is 72 or something.
Right,
you know?
The kind of the height of like all that, like Black Panthers and
yeah,
things
yeah.
like that.
And my dad owned shops in Oakland and San Francisco, and he kept those shops, but we moved out to the suburbs and he opened up more shops out there. And so we did a lot of growing up there. I'm the oldest of five kids.
Oh, five, okay.
So they were all born in the East Bay there. And yeah, so
is everyone still in town?
Some are in LA. Some, you know, one sister lived in Turkey for a couple of years, but she's in back. She's moving to London.
Okay,
You know, we're all over. But yeah, and then we have all of our Iraqi family living in Michigan. They all moved to Michigan, and my dad is the only one that went to California because my mom was here. So
right, I think I maybe remember there was this zine that you guys did,
yeah,
the Michigan zine,
yeah,
and I even had a CD in it. Was
mm-hmm.
that?
Mm-hmm.
Was that all Monopause music, or was it all
different
stuff?
There were a couple Monopause tracks. It was basically my brother and I, and we went for a wedding in late 94 and just decided to stay for 6 months and stay with the cousins.
Okay, that's maybe why I thought you spent a lot of time there. I mean,
yeah.
you weren't living there, you were just staying there.
Yeah, we would go there every year, but then that time we chose, you know, to stay for 6 months. And Monopause was, you know, already a band at that point, but we just took a six-month break. And thought it would be good to just spend some time out there. So that zine was called Deep North, and it was just mm-hmm. what we did, you know, out of boredom in the suburbs of Detroit. Really, we made a CD audio accompaniment for every page in the book, and yeah, I can still stand behind some of it.
Yeah.
It's not really out and available.
I'd have to dig it up. Yeah, I was like thinking, I was like, oh, maybe I should grab a track off that for this thing.
Our Great Lakes are touched upon by six Midwestern states. Before the settlers came, the Indians filled this open space. And people made their homes here from every creed and race.
The Indians called it Lake Michiguma, which became Michigan. And Longfellow's Shores of Gitche Gumee, from his famous poem Hiawatha, makes us feel he wrote it about these shores. You see how Gitche Gumee and Michiguma sound alike? You see how Gitche Gumee and Michiguma and Gitche Gumee and Guma Gitche and Michigitche Gumee Guma sound alike? You've all gone to kindergarten. So many Indians had been pushed out of the east, they began to settle in this area.
Lots of people in Michigan were not pleased with their prize. They saw it as a hopeless wilderness destined to be one forever.
You see how
Constitution
and
Constipation
sound alike?
At least that's the way the people of Michigan saw it when they applied for statehood. It seemed crazy. Ohio saw it another way, and war almost broke out between the two until Andrew Jackson figured out that Ohio had more settlers and therefore more votes. So he gave Toledo to Ohio. But he did give Michigan a consolation prize. Right here, shaped like a hand.
You see how
Constitution
and
consolation
and
constipation
sound alike?
Early Porist type stuff on there too.
Yeah, so how long was that a solo project?
Porist was started to be called Porist in 93, mm-hmm. I think, or 92, which was just anything that I did solo, multi-instrumentation. Mm-hmm. And
you would do live shows as that?
You know, Porist has only probably done like 7 or 8 live shows.
Because it would be hard to pull off a solo thing. I guess you have to hook up a bunch of samplers or something.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
A lot of it is sample-based now. Like the last record that I heard, right? A lot of it...
Less, actually. It started as more of a sample kind of outfit. But the last record I did, actually the real record I did was 2006. It was called Tourist.
To work on your own music, because right now you seem to like you've got a ton of things on your plate that involve a lot of traveling, and like you're running this other label, and I know you've been involved with Sublime Frequencies for a long time too, so it's like is it hard to kind of prioritize like making your own work when you're kind of like in this role where you're enabling a lot of things?
Yeah, it can get hard, because and it's the one thing I miss the most is really just doing my own stuff. So It's been on the back burner for way too long, and that's why it's taken 6 years to do a follow-up to Tourists, really. But now I'm really kind of trying to prioritize it and say, okay, July is going to be Porist month. And yeah, it's been really hard to do because of there's been so much going on. I mean, yeah. And there's been a lot of travel.
Yeah. Maybe we should break down what your multiple roles are, because we've got, like, okay, so we've kind of covered some of the solo music. Then, I don't remember the first thing I saw, but like, when did Sublime Frequencies kind of start up? Like
2003.
So you were very much involved in like the first couple things, right?
Alan and Hisham and Rick Bishop started Sublime Frequencies in 2003, and we were all hanging out at that time and, you know, sharing ideas and just kind of thought like, wow, well, we all do a lot of traveling and obviously we all collect a lot of music and we hear so much great stuff out there, but it's completely unrepresented here. You know, it's not... Mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff that we were hearing, like, we have a focus on, you know, 60s, 70s, and sometimes even more contemporary stuff mm-hmm. that's like hybrid, traditional pop, you know, electrified, and the kind of music that you that the people listen to out there. So,
right. Yeah.
The stuff you'll hear at you know, bus stops or restaurants in taxis and that kind of thing.
And that kind of came out of just, you guys are all pretty seasoned travelers.
Mm-hmm, yeah, we were all traveling quite a bit, yeah. and Alan's older, so he'd been traveling since the early 80s and collecting this stuff, and mm-hmm. you know, I started traveling in the late 90s to the Middle East and then to Southeast Asia and just doing repeat trips and really just getting into it.
Yeah.
And all the music we were hearing was, you know, and all the stuff we were taping off the radio, because that's mm-hmm. something we all do too. We kind of came together on that and thought, you know, we all have something to offer here, you know, yeah. as far as like, you know, completely underrepresented music that isn't, for some reason, isn't really being exported. And
with you specifically, when you went out to go traveling, did you know that part of it was you're going to do field recordings? Did you kind of plan that out? Or
yeah,
was it just because you're a music person, like, mm-hmm. I just got to find whatever music is going on in these towns? Or was it more like, I just got to see the world? Or, you know, like...
Mm-hmm. It was both. Yeah, I really wanted to see the world. I really wanted to get out of here. It took me like 5 years to, you know, finally get it together.
Saving money to go across the world used to be, I mean, it's still hard, but like, I think more people just do it now. And I just remember in the 90s being like, oh, I can't imagine going anywhere on a vacation. I just couldn't imagine putting the money together.
Yeah, and the world was a lot bigger then, too, pre-internet. Right. Or, you know, new internet was, you know...
Yeah, well, pre-internet, I would say, yeah, still. Because, like, I don't know how wired up people are in some of these places.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, at that time, not too many. And you know, there were still people here that didn't have email addresses mm-hmm. when I first left. But the...
Where's the first place you went on that trip,
then? Syria.
Okay.
Yeah, I just went right into it. And I took a cassette field recorder. It was 1997. Mm-hmm. Seeking out music that, you know, I knew must exist, like Debka music and other folk music that I knew had to be different than what I'd heard by...
Whatever got filtered a little bit through, yeah.
Big filtration system. Yeah. So, you know, just kind of going and checking it out and getting out of this country. And, you know, I mean, travel isn't that encouraged in this country still. I mean, like you're saying, people do it, but maybe even less so back then.
Yeah, people... I talked to someone who said, like, it should be mandatory if you're an American citizen to go travel.
Absolutely. Yeah. It will change your life if you let it. I mean, if you don't go with any humility, a lot of people come back and say, like, well, doesn't it make you appreciate where you live a lot more? And it's like, no, not at all. Yeah, not at all. I never came back thinking, thank God I live here, you know?
I mean, I've never done quite that kind of thing that you've done. Like, when I've been to Asia, it's always been a kind of a family thing, and so it's, like, mm-hmm. a little bit, like, a control thing. But, like, I kind of tried to, when I went to Hong Kong a while ago, I tried to, like, go out on my own and, like, find, like, record stores and find stuff.
Sure.
And it was, like... I don't know what I was looking for exactly. I was kind of thinking that I ended up seeing, like, oh, this is the equivalent of, like, the Aquarius Records of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily, like, talking about, like, the music that people listen to on the street. Or in the case of Hong Kong, when you're, like, on a subway or you're going to a restaurant, they're just listening to, like, pop. Like, super, super pop, produced pop things. Or, like, American music that gets over there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of... I felt like with Hong Kong in particular, I didn't know... It just seemed like it was all about making money, and I didn't know where the cultural things were coming in there.
Sure.
And I think a lot of places you go, or also when I went to China last, I was like, hey, did people have records? Did anyone make records? And they thought I wanted to go to a new CD store
yeah.
and buy new CDs. Yeah. You go into one of those places, they think like, oh, you're from America. You want to see where we have our best CDs on offer here. I'm like, no, I want to find like cassettes or like grimy old things. And I was kind of thinking about what you guys were doing. I was like, I was in China last summer, and I'm like, I started asking people, I'm like, hey, do your parents have records or anything? They're like, maybe. They probably got rid of it all.
Yeah.
There was this mental, and also, like, I think the government controlled so much in China that, mm-hmm. like who could afford to put out records?
Mm-hmm.
You know, only, like, the government could afford to put out records, and it would just be propaganda records or, like, something that represented, you know, the Republic or something.
Sure,
so,
sure.
And there's just a whole push towards new technology. I feel like I don't know if you've encountered that when you go somewhere, and then everyone's just like, yeah, it's like my grandma might have some of those things, but we just, hey, do you have an iPod?
It's like, this is really bringing up quite a bit, because a lot, I mean, and especially Well, I would say everywhere, the Middle East and Southeast Asia, both, a lot of priority is put on the new.
Yeah,
and
so much.
The old is meaningless.
And you can't blame them because, like, they didn't get that stuff that we've had for a while. At least in China, particularly. I'm like, they just want to do America better than America did.
Is that right?
Yeah, but, like, yeah, when you go to Southeast Asia or something.
Southeast Asia, or when I try to do research for stuff here, like when I talk to the Cambodian community about trying to find material or the Vietnamese community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, people have thrown away master tapes. They've thrown
so
away.
So crazy.
And it's not interesting to them anymore.
Right.
It's ephemeral. Period. Yeah. And that's, you know, yeah, you, like you said, you can't fault anyone for that. That's just a different way of looking at it. We have a really strong way of fetishizing and nostalgia and really deeply getting into stuff like mm-hmm. on the sort of collectors here, like collector's disease. You know?
And you and Alan and Rick.
Yeah, and some people are sicker than we are, you know. Yeah. Like, well, I mean, you get into like toys and comics and, you know, deep, you know, really deep.
Yeah.
Do you find that elsewhere, especially in a place like Japan, which has a similar mm-hmm. kind of MO, you know, or
they'll ditch like old recordings or anything. Like,
in Japan, no, they'll really get into the nostalgia.
Oh,
they'll be like super collectors.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You
like, that was in the, when they had more money. I like, had a friend who just sell old Levi's jeans to some guy in Japan. It's just like, you know, like, oh, this is a stitching from like 1963 or something. There's a you think of that collector mentality. Yeah,
they have it in Japan, and you can find it elsewhere. You know, here and there, you'll find collectors in India that really get into the old 78s and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, but less so. And in a country that's had a lot of wholesale destruction or trauma, like mm-hmm. Cambodia or Vietnam,
right?
I find that they will honor certain classic traditions, and they lost so much of their own traditions.
Right.
But
yeah,
like they had these great, you know, great singers who are revered and famous.
That film that you guys showed, actually, at that show we were talking about earlier, that was so like heartbreaking that it was based on an actual woman who was you know what I'm talking about,
Rose Soraya Sotia,
Cambodian
singer,
and it was like a sort of a dramatized version of that story, like they tried to force her to sing in the
That was a film by Greg Cahill mm-hmm. that he's also trying to get funding for to do a bigger production of. It's the story of Rose Soraya Sotia
mm-hmm.
and she and Sin Sisimuth, among many other singers, were kind of at the peak of Cambodian culture, which included cinema and mm-hmm. a lot of output in music and radio. And that was a period that lasted about 10 years, 65 to 75, or a bit earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shut down by the Khmer Rouge. And after that, it was just the wholesale loss of culture.
Yeah.
In the 80s, when they started regrouping and the refugees, the survivors had, you know, started popping up in the States
mm-hmm.
and France and elsewhere, they started recording in new studios and trying to resuscitate and make, you know, relevant contemporary music again.
Right.
A lot of it was imitation of these great singers who were murdered at the hands of Khmer Rouge. So they really idolized that and looked to that.
Mm-hmm.
They did some great stuff in the 80s. It's really like the forgotten decade for Cambodia, the 80s and early 90s.
Cambodian Americans
and Cambodian refugees. A lot of that stuff I started finding at the library here in Oakland in the 90s.
ตะเมตะกายคิงเสร่ลึกกบกลอตราโตกายคิงเสร่ลึกกบกลอตราโตอาเกียกบาลขมาววิ่งเหล่าโมโหอาเกียกบาลขมาววิ่งเหล่าโมโหรถโจรลุงสราโตกบมกบบาลสรูมามรถโจรกรุงกาโตกบมกบบาลสรูมา
So a lot of that was, okay, maybe that's in the liner notes. A lot of those were refugees from here.
Yeah, those and right? That because yeah. The 80s material in particular, you know, that became the focus of the Cambodian Cassette Archives release. Mm-hmm. And I still collect that stuff, and I'm working on a second volume. But in doing that and trying to get research done and trying to find other recordings from the 80s, you know, I've had conversations with people who've thrown away entire collections of the 80s stuff because it's irrelevant. The 80s didn't, you know, it's not. It's all about now and the new house material and like remixed versions of this and that. And same with Vietnamese music when I was trying to do this Vietnamese comp.
I totally had this weird moment of that when I used to, when my old job and I had this intern who was Vietnamese American and I was playing some really sick like Vietnamese like field recording. I don't remember where I got it from. I don't think it was you guys, but. It was, he just was like walked in the room and it was like it was when I worked at a label, so he was a music guy. He was just like, "You're listening to this?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "This is like stuff my parents listen to."
Yeah.
I'm like, "Yeah, it's pretty awesome, right?" But like he has a completely different relationship with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember growing up listening to all this they were, my parents would maybe have like these like Taiwanese like singers like cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, you know, the Debbie Gibsons and the Tiffany's of Taiwan.
Sure.
And I just was like, oh, this is bullshit. Like, I like the Talking Heads and, you know, the Smiths. And I wasn't, like,
going
to cotton to any of it. I might have a different take on it. Or I should have just saved this stuff and given it to you guys. I'm sure you'd love that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny growing up with the Iraqi music, too. My dad, he listened to that stuff up until I was about 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
So I still have his 8 tracks, and he had records and tapes, and he would get the Arabic newspaper in the mail. And when I was about 11 or 12, he stopped all of it. He threw away everything, threw away his clothes, and he just kind of reinvented himself as an American guy.
Right.
And that's what he wanted. He wanted the American dream, and yeah. Suddenly that he had a lot of Arabic friends too. They didn't show up anymore. We had this.
Did he talk to you about it, or you just noticed the change, like a sea change?
I noticed the change, but it came for me at a time when I really was clearly not into being identified as Arab American or half Arab American.
Mm-hmm.
Politically, it was so charged at that time, and I think assimilation was his deal, and it kind of fit right into me going through. You know, young adulthood and wanting to be as American as possible because, you know, you don't want difference here. It's like America doesn't really welcome it. As much as they may say they do, it's really about assimilating here. And I think it's one of the most hardcore experiences that for all foreigners that come here.
Man, I
that
actually,
aren't European in origin.
Yeah. I'm kind of getting a little bit of like a realization about that in a way because I work with a bunch of people that are from China directly. And I kind of feel like an asshole a lot of the time because I'm just like, I don't talk to them that much or I don't relate to them. And I don't know if it almost is going back to this thing of like, I don't want people to think like I'm hanging out with the fobs or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though like it's 80% fobs where I work. And it's just like, I'm the outlier. I'm the weirdo. And it's a weird parallel thing of like, I feel marginalized again. Like I'm not in with the cool kids, but I also like have my own other thing going on, which I can't even explain
it
to any of them.
It gets pretty meta, doesn't it?
I can't even explain it to any of them. And I, you know, just from, there's a comic book that a guy I actually went to Chinese school with. Did, which is kind of covers a lot of this stuff. It's called American Born Chinese. And it went through this whole thing of like, you know, being the immigrant or children of the first generation trying to assimilate and how you kind of almost like deny associating with other, you know, people from your background.
Yeah, yeah.
And like now as an adult, also had another thing. Like I had to go to Chinese school. I don't know if you had a parallel experience. Did you have anything like that? Like language school or anything like
no,
that?
No, I didn't.
A lot of my friends that have like their parents were immigrants. Like even my friend, she went to Greek school on like Saturdays mm-hmm. or like, mm-hmm. you know, obviously like, you know, people go to like Sunday school or Saturday school.
Right.
But there was just this thing. Like I would just go on Saturday to another school. Another day. I'm like, I have 6 days of school. This sucks.
Yeah.
And this is one where I'm in a language I don't know that well. And, like, I actually absorb a lot of Mandarin Chinese, a ton of it from growing up around it. But sure. I'm not really well-versed in it. I can't really talk an adult conversation with someone in Chinese. And it was always this thing of like, oh, you're going to really regret that you're not in touch with your roots. And I'm like, I'm not even in touch with American roots, like, in a way. I was, like, trying to, like, build this other thing of my identity, which is, like, I'm going to be into, I'm into weird music and comic books and, like...
Subculture. And,
subculture, which felt to me like a good place. When you're, like, you know, you come from that background... Like, just, like, you know, you want to just create your own thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've had that experience, too, because your dad immigrated,
He immigrated, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing. You know, I certainly, you know, I didn't want to talk about it with people. I didn't want to hear that Arabic trash in my, you know, this is when I'm 11 or 12. It was, my friends
was
would come over.
Was there a lot of anti-Arabic
A lot, yeah,
I feel
a
like it was in the 80s, like when, like,
70s,
like,
80s.
Like, Back to the Future will come out, and, like, oh, there's these terrorists trying to get, you know, the plutonium.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I was a little bit older. Like, I was 15 when that came out, probably. And then there was...
Well, because, you know, oh, the oil crisis was, like, in the late
hostage
70s.
Hostage crisis. I got called Gaddafi, the Shah, you know, like, all that.
In, like, Dublin or where?
In the 70s, in Walnut Creek and all that area.
I guess now I would even think you might call that in Walnut
Creek.
I think
you might get called something worse, you know.
Yeah, that's true. We'll post 9/11.
I'm sure now one of your classmates can make a call and you can be put away in Guantanamo, you know, you and your dad.
Well, I mean, like, even they were, like, pro, I remember, like, maybe it was Danville or Walnut Creek when they were, like, pro Johannes Meserle. Like, you know, they were like, we support Johannes Meserle, like the guy who shot Oscar Grant.
Right,
it's like, how can you be... If you've looked at anything on there, you can't be pro that guy, matter what. There's, like, no matter what your take on that issue was.
Yeah,
like,
they're trying to send a message. I mean, it's so polarized,
isn't
it?
It's so crazy, yeah.
But, you know, and I think
it's
when
the... suburbs, man. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs, but I grew up in San Jose. There were still, like, tons of, like, Latino people around. It was, like, still, like, a pretty ethnically diverse mix. Well, Walnut Creek is, like... pretty white. That's, like, a pretty white town.
Yeah, well, I think nowadays it's probably... When I go there, it's less white than it used to be, for sure. I mean, now there are Asians and Indians and affluent immigrants.
Yeah, like the affluent minority, the aspiring, aspiring towards upper middle class, like, you know, that thing.
It's similar to where we sit right now in Alameda. That's the case.
Oh, man, Alameda is... Oh, we didn't even talk about that.
We'll get there, but I wanted to say...
So you and your brother both had that experience, you think?
Yeah, I'd say we both did. It's kind of like the wholesale, you know, abandonment of your culture is encouraged. It's not, there's no guidebook for it. Nobody says this is what you have to do, but you're made to feel, especially if you're my dad, somebody with a heavy accent that I don't even know if he hears, but he's still got it. You know, you're made to feel like unless you're doing everything in your power to try and adapt to where you are, you're not going to be accepted by most of society. So people like that tend to cling to Fox News, right-wing ideals, just be as white and as American as possible, and whatever their vision of that is. So my teen years, definitely all about subculture.
Yeah.
Right? Just
did your dad
rejecting
super,
that.
Was he super conservative? Did he go towards
Fox
News?
Oh, yeah, he is.
He still currently is.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And that's just where he landed. That's how he interprets it.
Maybe I don't know the whole background. Like, when he left Iraq, what was the political situation going on there? He didn't leave for any political reason. He just left
to go seek out the Western dream, I think. Yeah. You know, he grew up, you know, colonized Iraq. You know, the British were there. They looked toward America. They got British films. Baghdad was a tourist destination where Americans would go to Baghdad. It was an exotic location. It was, you know, it wasn't demonized like at all, like now.
Yeah. We're in Baghdad by the bay and like to the middle of a country that's like, that seems right. Yeah.
Right.
The Baghdad of the bay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, at that time he went to Germany and kind of just sought out the Western life. And I think most
found
of
it.
Yeah, he found it.
Del Monte winner.
Yeah. I think he just wanted to be accepted. And that's what most people do. I mean, there's a funny assimilation story. Like, if we're going to go this deep, there was in West Oakland, there was a guy running a shop where I was living in West Oakland for 20 years. And the guy was Hispanic, right? He had a Filipino wife. And yeah, I walked in there one day and then they started carrying these kind of, you know, hard shell tortillas. And I said, hey, you know, wow, you got tortillas in here. And he cut me off. He said, is that what those are? I have no idea. I don't know what they call those, man. Is that what they call them? And it's like, all right, man, you know, you're clearly Hispanic. And, you know, it's like, this is, I love that story because it's so typical of,
right,
you know,
the way there's a little deniability, like plausible deniability.
Yeah,
like,
I would have like, no idea what that is. That's what those people do, you know,
right,
that kind of thing. And it's just, it's like, you know, it's somehow it's really encouraged to abandon your culture in that way. And I feel like my teens were spent doing that and really kind of, you know, embarrassed of those Arabic 45s and, you know, the Kulthum and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think what happened was, and if this hadn't happened, things may have been different. But when the first Gulf War happened, my dad was running a pizza place at that time. We owned a couple pizza places, and my brother and I would work for him. It was 1990, you know, we're in there in Concord running this shop, and people were coming in with T-shirts on that said "Fuck Iraq," and coming up and asking, "Where are you from?" And you know, somebody's wearing that shirt and asking that, you know,
and you're like, at that point,
I mean, that's the answer, right? Yeah. But they, you know what they're really asking.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, my dad would always say, I'm Greek, or I'm Armenian, or I'm Italian, and then, you know, but you can't win. But I think that's what really happened is I started seeing that and started thinking, like, well, here we go, you know. Arabs are getting demonized, you know, the Gulf War is happening. I had no idea that that Iraq would be, you know, completely decimated within 10 years, but it started to politicize me more, even though, you know, actually what's interesting is being part of subculture in the 80s, in the mid-80s as a young teen.
Everything's like fuck Reagan and all that
stuff. It was fuck Reagan, fuck apartheid, you know, this and that and the other thing. Learn about El Salvador, learn about covert wars that this country's fighting in South America, and really learn about it. That was part of subculture.
Right.
You couldn't be into weird music without being aware politically or trying to be aware politically.
Well, that music was more strident and more willing to take those stands. And also, in a weird way, you would get like Crass, or you'd get people talking about, you know, animal rights, or you'd get like all these very specific, like, the punk had a lot of messages.
It did.
Going directly into it.
And I feel like you weren't allowed to be, you just weren't going to be taken seriously if you were part of subculture and didn't have some kind of political context, you know, and understanding. And that shifted at some point, I think, that, you know, it really, being subculture became sort of being apolitical at some point. There was a turn.
Okay.
And that's really striking to me because I have to go back in my head and remember that if you saw someone in suburban mid-80s that dressed different, that already meant that they're probably listening to this music. Yeah. And it was like a uniform of responsibility and context. I mean, I'm glorifying it to a degree.
Right. You would be able to be like, okay, this person is willing to stand out and like...
But then that shift that removed the political part of it from subculture is something a little bit depressing. You know, depressing.
How would you identify it, or what would you say it is? Because I think I know what time period you're talking about.
Yeah.
Maybe it was around the time like Nirvana broke, like 92, 93. Yeah,
absolutely. Where it just became, you know, it just got dumbed down. And I think we've seen a dumbing down from that point on. I mean, things were pretty dumb in the 80s too, but you know, that, at least
in a different direction.
Yeah, there was kind of the prerequisite of like you have to kind of be aware of this stuff, and that evaporated.
Let's kind of fast forward to, okay, so you knew the Bishops kind of just from, they knew about your band, or they just knew you, or like...
Well, I was a huge Sun City Girls fan as a kid. Like when I was 15, I heard their first record and started buying their records back in the 80s. And it seemed like they disappeared for a while, like after 88 or so.
Yeah, they kind of had a little bit of a dormancy.
I think they were traveling a lot.
Okay.
And they came back in 1990, with Torture of the Mystics, and kind of just kept going from there and got really super prolific. So I was a longtime fan. I finally got to see them like in 91 and saw a lot of their shows after that. But what brought us together was... The Nunpok show that we did up in Seattle, Brentley wanted to book it with Alvarius B.
Okay.
And so we had a chance to talk and, you know, talk about travels and Burma and other things.
That last Alvarius B record is so good.
Yeah.
I like that one
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, yeah.
Oh, God. He's got some real surprises coming up.
Oh, man.
But That's where we first met, and then, you know, friendship started from there, and met a lot of great people up in Seattle. So, you know, the Bishop brothers, Rob Millis, Hisham Mayette, you know, everybody that was to become Sublime Frequencies, and that's how that started.
Yeah. So, and like I was saying, you were kind of on the ground floor of that movement. And I feel like at this point, like, would you call it a movement? I don't know. I think at this point there's like a cluster of things that kind of overlap in terms of what the goals are. Like, I think like what you guys do, there's like some of the Mississippi Records stuff. And then, like, you know, like, I don't know, Ian Nagoski.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like, there's this sort of, like, I think it's, like, a record nerd thing, and then this sort of anthropological interest in, like, things that are just hard to find, obscurities. Yeah. And,
yeah. It's certainly accelerated in the last 3 years, especially. Yeah.
It does feel like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you would know, because, like, you guys put out records, and you know.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch, and it's interesting to see how Sublime Frequencies, you know, it's been almost 10 years, so how it gets looked at as you look backward and see, you know, what the relevance of it was and what the, you know, there was an urgency to it as we were starting to do it. And
well, because do you think that some of that had to do with the fact that we were in a war already and things like that, or
well, with some of my releases, like, yeah.
The Chubby Chubby one,
yeah, I did the,
which is great, yeah,
the Iraqi one, and I Remember Syria was an audio document that Sublime put out that I'd done based on the early trips to Syria that I'd taken. And yeah, there was an urgency in that respect for those releases, but also an urgency because we had so many ideas and had so much music, and we still do,
yeah.
You know. But we have stockpiles of this stuff that we've just been collecting, and we were meeting a lot of great people overseas and working out deals and trying to figure out how to put out some of this stuff. And I think the urgency came from just knowing that that this stuff hadn't been released and hadn't been given a life.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago. You know, I mean, first of all, we were alone in doing that, in a sense, in the way we were doing it. But it started, I think people were influenced by that, and I think you can see it in a lot of the other kinds of, like, the Thai music thing. You know, for instance, like we did some of the first Pop Molam releases and Thai pop in the West, and you know, you can see when people started reissuing them, they would use the same spellings that we did, and there's myriad spellings but possibilities, right, for these. Cambodia Rocks came out before Sublime Frequencies, and that was kind of something.
When did that come out?
I think it was 96.
Who was it?
I can't remember his name, but he didn't put his name on the record.
Right.
But it was one of those records that really shook my world up, and in that, you know, I liked music from Southeast Asia, but this was really, I mean, how, I'd never heard of that. I've never heard of a vital rock and roll movement in the 60s in Cambodia, and that was a great influence for me. So I know that Sublime probably did influence people
Well, there's also something. This label, it was Awesome Tapes from Africa.
Yeah,
that came out.
Which came out of a blog.
A lot of the blog stuff, I feel like a lot of the stuff ended up on blogs. So maybe that's another way to think about it now. Like, now that, like, CDs have become kind of a diminished format, is the stuff that you're doing, would it, there be any way to do it? Do you see a different purpose for it than just putting out records, or like maybe like putting stuff up for free, or like what do you think in terms of that stuff, or like putting stuff like on iTunes, or are you doing all that stuff? Or
there's a lot to talk about in that area.
You guys have liner notes and stuff and your stuff.
Sometimes we like to leave it mysterious because it's or we have to because it's still a mystery to us. We just like the music and we're not going to spend 25 years trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And sometimes things are a lot sweeter if you leave them mysterious, you know. Right. And that could be taken any way. Look, where the world has shrunk in 10 years. It's since we started doing this on this level, it really did shrink quite a bit. And now there's so much information on any of these artists and any of these movements.
Mm-hmm.
Some it's still, you know, really not that well documented, but others really, you know. You don't have to write an encyclopedia every time you release a record. Some people think you do. It's just about an approach, and it's what you're comfortable doing.
Yeah.
And I'm quite comfortable, you know, trying to find out as much as I can about a movement or groups, especially in a compilation. but not overkilling it, not overdoing it, because mm-hmm. once you do that, you're kind of writing the Bible for that music, and yeah. you're writing, like, you know, you're cementing it. Mm-hmm. It's not made of cement. We're not in the West here. We're talking about, and people say, well, you're exoticizing or any of these idiot talks, right?
You still get that a lot?
Oh, yeah.
That from a lot of corners?
Yeah.
But, like, from who? Like, that's the other thing I wonder sometimes. Like,
academics?
Yeah, because not from the people that are in that community, right?
Not at all. No. This is the thing.
That's the thing, kind of like the Heavenly Ten Stem thing in a way. Sort of like, if some other, like, at least, well, there's, like, a Chinese person being offended by something Asian, but it's, like, also, like, I don't even know anything about this music that those guys were doing, and I'm Chinese, or Chinese-American.
Right.
I would have, you know, if it bothered me, I would maybe say something, but at the same time, like, then there is a thing of, like, well, you're also just an academic, and maybe you have an investment in this stuff, or maybe you don't have an investment in this stuff, mm-hmm. but you just like critiquing people.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, people are paid to talk and criticize, and, mm-hmm. you know, people, it's just, there's a lot of guilt, and there's a lot of, you know, channels that people think have to be, you know, explored to present something from another country.
Yeah.
There are no rules. There's people who say that there are rules. Mm-hmm. There are people who really believe it should be one way, or mm-hmm. that it should be handled a certain way. And there are people who adhere to that and then go to these countries and don't have any experiences at all, actually. They might go to the country and go to the Ministry of Culture and say, mm-hmm. bring culture to me. I'm in this office over here on this street.
Right. They're not finding in the street.
Or anything. And so then they're not going to hear the real deal. I mean, that's changing. That's old school mm-hmm. a little bit, I think, mm-hmm. I hope. But, you know, so basically it's just about presenting it the way that we feel comfortable presenting it, and people have enjoyed it, and we, you know, there's just no set way that I operate or that the label operates either. Mm-hmm. I think that each release is a different animal, and you treat it differently. And,
so when did the shift start happening from when it was, like, for example, like the collection of the tapes and then digitizing the tapes and sort of being a curator of that stuff to working with, like, an artist, like in the case of, like, Omar Suleiman or something? You're just like, I'm actually going to work with a living artist that I'm in contact with, and there's going to be more of that dynamic.
Well, that shift happened in 2006 when I'd been a collector and fan of Omar Suleiman's tapes for 9 years. Mm-hmm. And I just kept it a secret, really. I shared it with a few people. You know, I mean, I didn't think anybody would really like it.
Oh, yeah, because the first time you went to Syria, did you find out about him?
Yeah.
He's, like, really popular.
Well, at that time, he was only a year into singing.
Oh, really?
His career was a year old, and he had tapes that were being produced out of his village and sent out within Syria, you know, domestically. Wedding tapes, you know, like mm-hmm. festive party songs, loud, fast, raw. Mm-hmm. And it really grabbed me. I was buying so many tapes back then in Syria. And there are many others and many more, you know, that not just Omar, but I happen to have bought the most Omar tapes because I really liked that sound. And they were on the forefront of what gets called New Wave Debki now.
Okay.
And Debki being the traditional celebratory mm-hmm. dance and music.
That's a good transition to talk about this. I mean, I do want to come back to the Omar thing in a second. But yeah, so this is on... This is this collection that you put together. Which obviously, it's a radio thing, so I have to explain what it is. It's an LP... Dabka, Sounds of the Syrian Huron,
Huron is a region of Syria. It's in the south. It also extends into Jordan and Palestine. Mm-hmm. This is Debki music that, you know, people may have first heard of Debki through Omar Suleiman and through those CDs we released. Mm-hmm. This LP, this is on my newish label called Sham Palace. Mm-hmm. And, Debki you know, it's employed by people all over the Levant. So there's Lebanese-style Debki, Palestinian-style Debki. Mm-hmm. There's Omar's brand of Debki, which mm-hmm. is northeastern Syria, which is, you know, they're right up against the Turkish border, near the Iraqi border, informed by all of that music. Mm-hmm. This is more Bedouin-informed and has a heavier vibe, you know, than the Omar stuff.
is there like because New Wave Gypsy is something it was more like keyboard and kind of synthesizer stuff?
Yeah, it's when they electrified the Debkey music.
So the traditional Debkey
it goes way back and they played, you know, they played it with hand drums and mm-hmm. medjwiz, which is the double reed flute, mm-hmm. And various other instruments depending on what region they were in, yeah. and what instruments they had. But so, this is a result of, you know, 15 years of collecting mm-hmm. Debkey music from all over the country, okay. and then really honing in on the Southern sound, mm-hmm. because it's really a sound that I felt like, especially after Omar Suleiman inundation, mm-hmm. you know, I think people need a broader context of what Debkey may sound like elsewhere yeah. in the country. And so this is a collection of artists, some of my favorite artists from that mm-hmm. part of Syria that, yeah. And it's culled from cassettes and discs as well.
Yeah,
found in shops there.
Like when they're making, have you talked to people about the production of like when they're going into it, like what kind of production like mindset they have about making the music?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of these performers mm-hmm. Play parties, weddings. All of these are none of them are studio recordings. They're all live. They're all from parties and weddings. Okay. And they're all right off the soundboard. Mm-hmm. Some were released on cassette in the late 90s, and they're all live, and they're all varying quality. But it's mm-hmm. it's really, that's one of the best parts about it to me. It's mm-hmm. just kind of like the urgency of a live recording. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, some of the studio attempts, mm-hmm. or some of the, you know, there are Debkey artists that record in the studio.
Yeah,
I've heard their songs live. And
it just doesn't really work the same.
It's interesting in Syria. What can happen is a wedding song mm-hmm. from a VCD, the live sound and everything, can be distributed throughout the country, and suddenly one of the songs can become a hit based on that version that they did at that wedding. Mm-hmm. So even in the middle of the song, they're shouting the names of the bride and the groom and that sort of thing.
Viral marketing for the bride and groom.
Like yeah, that. Yeah. And in the video, you'll see like the family dancing, and it's, you know, that becomes immortalized because suddenly everyone latches on to that great song.
Right.
And then, in the case of there was a singer named Sari El-Sawas, mm-hmm. they took that song and said, let's produce it and let's do it in the studio.
Okay.
It doesn't have the same vibe mm-hmm. and the same urgency, mm-hmm. You know.
And so, you put out a record for Omar Suleiman also, right, on the same label?
Yeah, the first record on Sham Palace was Lay Johnny, which is a song that I put on Highway to Hasaki, the anthology, in mm-hmm. 2007. I had edited that song down from 30 minutes to 3.5 minutes for Highway to Hasaki.
Just do it for 30 minutes? Like,
yeah, most of their songs are about 30 to 40 minutes.
Okay.
And so all of the Omar stuff has been mm-hmm. truncated mm-hmm. With his approval. And
right.
You know, I mean, that's the only way to be able to present this stuff live or in the studio.
Right.
Or on tape.
Unless how are you going to put like, you know, a couple of 30-minute tracks together on a release?
But that's what I did for the Sham Palace release. I thought it could be good if people could hear this for the first time.
Okay, as a complete thing.
As is. And so mm-hmm. it's basically one full cassette of Omar's that contains three songs, and it became a double record.
Okay. When I looked on SoundCloud, there was like a bunch of remixes of that song, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think people just do it on their own. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that also ties into, I think you mentioned this, like you sort of were the go-between or the hookup for the thing that he did with Bjork?
Yeah, yeah.
So how did that all work out?
Bjork was, Bjork had become a big fan of his music through the Sublime Frequencies releases, and we received a communique from One Little India and Bjork's management she wanted to see if Omar was interested in remixing one of her tracks that she was working on for a new album.
Mm-hmm.
And
does he do that
though? Well, see, that's the thing.
That's not a thing that he would
do. No, he didn't know. He doesn't know what a remix is. He didn't know who Bjork was.
Well, that's also, remix is like, not part of that culture.
Not at all. No.
Yeah. And is hip-hop big in Syria? Do people know hip-hop in Syria?
You know, they know it.
Yeah.
And they know all kinds of Western stuff, from George Michael to, you know, Metallica to, you know, this is world music for them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not big. It's background. Mm-hmm. You know, I think some kids in Damascus who really want to get into it, like, mm-hmm. they'll make that their lifestyle. And
you
can see that, just like Lebanon or anywhere.
Right.
The answer was, I mean, I had to talk to the Bjork people and say, look, I think you'd like you'd like the Omar Suleiman sound for the new Bjork stuff, so mm-hmm. why don't we do a collaboration?
Yeah.
And get me and an engineer to Istanbul, and I'll get the guys to Istanbul, and we'll spend 3-4 days there working on stuff. Give us tracks. I can't say it's going to be a remix, but I think it's going to have to be a collaboration. Well, Bjork loved that idea.
Yeah.
and made that happen. Mm-hmm. I knew that once we got it into the studio, I'd have to have a pretty solid idea of what the arrangement would have to be, because so for them, they come in with songs and they're ready and they're like, you know, they don't really collaborate.
I was going to say, like, so you have stems for a thing. And do they do much studio stuff? I mean, obviously.
They do some studio stuff. So they have a handful of studio records that Razan, the keyboardist, actually has produced. But they've never tried to merge it with another singer in Syria, really. You know, it's never.
And then Bjork is like such an alien kind of quantity in her own way. She's such an out there person.
Absolutely. And I got the stems for those and I started thinking about, okay, what will work with this? Just sat with it and tried starting arranging it in Pro Tools and thinking like, all right, I think an Iraqi Chobi sound would be good with this song. And then I would take a live version of something I had recorded of him and tried putting her stems over it just haphazardly to see if that would sound good. Yeah. And so after forming these ideas, I brought it into the studio and played them Bjork's tracks, and they were scratching their heads like, I mean, I said, well, jam in this melody, try this, and then now let's do, and then took it separately and said, now do a Chobi beat, do a Debki beat, and try, you know, just kind of got, we made
using
it go somewhere.
Her as like samples, or like turning her stems into like maybe a rhythmic element or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we should just play that. Right now.
Sure, let's play one of those tracks. Let's play Tesla, because I think that's my favorite. That's not the hit, but it's the B-side.
B-sides are always good. Yeah. What she's all kind of notorious for doing that is, like, bringing in these kind of, you know, like, she did a record with Matmos. She just did a thing with, like, a couple years ago, she did some with Chris Corsano and, like, Brian Chippendale and all these people. So
yeah, she really does really good at, like, reach out. And
so she's got her finger into all these things. So,
she does. Yeah. Yeah, she's, I feel like, and you know, she didn't have to like the way that this turned out, but she really did. So yeah, it was a really real success, and I think it surprised a lot of Bjork fans.
Yeah.
Probably turned off some people because it's a very alien. I mean, it really sounds like a Syrian pop track and Iraqi pop track, and that was the point. I wanted.
That's
it.
Probably that's how what I she wanted. Yeah, it seems like what she wanted.
Yeah, apparently she liked it, and a lot of people just went crazy over it.
Yeah. Well, so backing up a little bit, you ended up after meeting him in 06. So there was a part of the story where you met him in 06 and then worked on that record that came out in 07?
Yeah.
And then, so there was, like, a lot of, like, editing that stuff down, and then how did the rest of that sort of evolve, like, your involvement with him?
Well, I wasn't sure how people were going to receive that first record, because for me, I mean, that music was really personal and something I, you know, I'd been going to Syria a lot, listening to a lot of Iraqi and Syrian music, and it was really... Not just personal, but I thought it was very alien for people. You know, I would play Omar for people in those first 9 years, and some people couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. You know, some people thought it was interesting, but had no interest in it, really. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, very different reactions.
Yeah.
Chris Cones, remember him? He was actually somebody who really got into it, especially some of the slow jams. And asked me to make him a CDR collection. And I thought, well, that's daunting because each track is 30 minutes. But I thought, well, that's just the fire I need to actually try to compile something. So I made him a CDR.
Oh, so Chris Cones. We can thank Chris Cones.
You can thank Chris
AKA
Cones.
A.K.A. Skullcaster.
That's right.
For sparking the editing process.
So. That's right, yeah. And so I made these couple CDRs, and people loved them, you know, a handful of friends. And then I proposed it to Sublime Frequencies. It was a little more contemporary and keyboard oriented than what Sublime were doing.
Because at that point, it was mostly just kind of archival things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
60s and 70s stuff. And Hisham was going to be working with Group Douay simultaneously. Yeah. So that was the other contemporary. That was happening at once.
Yeah.
So.
Both of those things kind of use a lot of, like, phase shifty, flangey kind of sounds.
Absolutely, right?
That's
yeah.
Like kind of the thing that I identified the most. It's like,
Whoa,
they just love that phase shift.
Yeah, and I do too.
Yeah.
And so what happened is that the record was received very well, and I made a video for Lay Johnny using VCD material from weddings and stuff that I'd collected in Syria, and stuff that I'd shot when I went to meet Omar at a few parties. Mm-hmm. Really started getting a lot of hits, you know, early viral type stuff, you know, in its own way. Very surprising. And a year and a half later, maybe, Alan and I were in Jakarta, Indonesia, and we got an email from a production company in Bristol, UK, called Q Junctions. They're great. They wondered what it would take to get Omar Suleiman and Group Douay live together in the UK. And that, I mean, that was our reaction. We just laughed, you know. I was like, no, you know, I really can't see it. But then, you know, the funding was
there's
there.
Funding in England.
There's funding. Funding in England. That's right. And that funding came from, among other people, the British Arts Council, among other entities.
And also, then you met Chris Tipton when you did the London show, right?
Yeah.
So he did your London show.
Yeah.
Or you probably had multiple London shows.
Well, we had London shows. We had all over UK. We did a UK extensive UK and European tour with Group Douay and Omar Suleiman. It was insane in a bus.
Yeah.
And that is what sent Omar over the top.
For instance,
the Sonar Festival in Barcelona.
Yeah.
That's where people like Bjork and others really, really got to see Omar and what he could pull off. I mean, we weren't sure how he could pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
Putting together the live shows was pretty intense because, again, they're used to playing 30 or 40-minute versions of stuff. Mm-hmm. The stuff that they were doing by 2007 was very different sounding than the stuff that was on Highway to Hosokee.
Mm-hmm.
Even, I would say, cheesier and more... less urgent sounding and more glossy and kind of like using, you know, English samples sometimes or like doing just kind of, yeah, just kind of a different vibe that I know that's not why we were asked to bring Omar. So, you know, I ended up directing the live set and truncating it and timing it. We ended up doing these vigorous rehearsals where I proposed these songs. They were saying, oh my God, we haven't played those songs in years. No, people don't want to hear that. Mm-hmm. So actually they do, you know, they really do. And so we kind of gave these songs that they hadn't been doing for years new life. And I asked him if they could bring the old keyboards too, because it really made a difference. And he did, and it was a little bit like, you know,
okay. What were the keyboards that they wanted to use? What are the old keyboards they're doing?
Well, just like we were talking about, out with the old, in with the new.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the 90s, you know, they were using, and they had less money, and they were using cheaper keyboards, whatever was making its way into the Middle East. They could do quarter tones or not. Mm-hmm. And so he was using, you know, Korg 01 at the time when he did Lay Johnny, and even older stuff. So a lot of the drum rolls and stuff come from the old keyboards. That's not what they wanted to sound like. That's what they sounded like, out of necessity.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of like going back to that thing, yeah, like the people that like threw out all their old like recordings or the ephemera, like, or like when I told my aunt has all these clothes from the 70s from Taiwan, I was like, you know, I could probably sell those now to some like young hipster. And she's like, oh, you want old clothes? And then she'll show me all these J. Crew things that she got in the last 5 years. I'm like, no. This stuff is the stuff that's good. But like in her mind, she wants to like get the new whatever Polar Fleece
thing. Yeah, yeah.
So that's like the Polar Fleece of keyboards, probably.
Probably like the Polar Fleece of keyboards.
Yeah.
But we ended up, you know, putting that show together pretty well and timed it at an hour. And, you know, it went over really well and ended up making four more records for Omar in the West.
That whole European festival circuit, that probably was like a new thing for you too, because it's not like Monopause. Did you guys ever tour Europe or anything?
Nungpok tour was asked to play some great shows in Portugal, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. So, mm-hmm. you know, I had...
Oh, you had done that circuit.
Done that a couple of times. And was there anything before that? No, I think this was my intro to the deep world. Festival scene, you know, where it's, you know.
Maybe even Jason had done a little bit of that. And like, Crack did some Europe touring.
Yeah.
So he probably was from, and then like Liz like ended up living over there.
Oh, yeah.
So she knows what's up over there.
She did the right thing, yeah.
Is she back now? I thought she was like living in grad school.
Berlin is her home, but I think she's between Berlin and Connecticut.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing teaching in Connecticut as well. So, but the, you know, I think anybody with their head on straight is going to leave this country if they can. And I'm next.
The follow-up, yeah. Actually, I'm surprised, because you kind of could, well, you ended up marrying a UK person, so you could have probably just gone straight up to the UK, right?
Could have, but there was unfinished business here, mm-hmm. and unfortunately for her, I had to bring her here.
And she didn't like West Oakland?
Well, you know, we're gonna try and go, we're going to Malaysia probably, and Southeast Asia for 6 months.
Oh,
we're
cool.
Scouting out a few places, and with the eventual purpose of leaving permanently and becoming expats from the Bay Area at this point that have vacated
like that guy who's got that spot in the Czech Republic,
George.
Well, yeah, Behringer. Yeah, I don't know if you have this. This is like a CD I put out of George Behringer's stuff. I think it's, you know, great. But,
wow, thanks.
Yeah, just to check out.
Yeah, sure.
So, Mark, great. The sound
as always,
of a handshake.
George.
Yeah. Birthday buddy, we're on in 2 hours.
Bandmate,
yeah.
Peak hours in the nighttime minutes. Yeah. Look out for us.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, George. Yeah.